podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm talking with Dr. Richard Pearcey of the RVC's Department of Veterinary Clinical Sciences about his research interests and clinical interests in the phenomenon of equine exertional rhabdomyolysis. Well, hello, Richard, and thank you very much for joining us. Your expertise is obviously in equine medicine, and you're particularly interested in muscle disease. So I wonder if you could start off by telling us about the common diseases of muscle that one would encounter in working horses.
Well, yes. Hi, Mark. Basically, in the UK, we deal with effectively one syndrome that affects working horses, and that is a syndrome that's known as exertional rhabdomyolysis, and it's by far the most important and most common disease of working horses from the perspective of muscle that's seen in this country. There are other diseases of muscle that affect horses that are seen perhaps with a higher incidence in other countries, but certainly in the UK it would be exertional rhabdomyolysis.
Okay, and thinking back to long ago in my undergraduate years, is that synonymous with tying up syndrome? What exactly is exertional rhabdomyolysis?
Yeah, so exertional rhabdomyolysis has been given a variety of names over the years, some of which are largely historical. Set fast is a term that's sometimes used to apply to thoroughbred racehorses. We use azoturia, Monday morning disease, myoglobinuria. There are a variety of different names for this syndrome, but the technical term really is exertional rhabdomyolysis.
Okay, so what does this actually reflect then clinically? How would it be recognised by an owner?
Okay, so, well, effectively, you know, the name exertional rhabdomyolysis means a disease of skeletal muscle that's brought on as a result of exercise. And typically, these horses are affected sometimes only after very light exercise, sometimes after more strenuous exercise. And what happens is that they tend to shorten up, they stiffen up, and they start to sometimes develop a slight lameness. And that may develop to become much more severe to the extent that the horse may not be able to move at all. They may become recumbent, start sweating, the heart rate starts to go up. And in very serious cases, and rarely, horses may actually die from this problem.
And is it a problem that tends to occur sporadically or recur in the same individuals, or is it something that crops up in particular breeds? Or
I think each of those three things is correct. So for a long time, people felt that this was a sporadic problem that potentially affected all horses. And that may be true to some extent, but particularly in horses that perhaps are doing exercise, or the amount of exercise that they're being asked to do is beyond what they are trained to do. That's one possibility. So that would perhaps encompass the sporadic types.
Uh-huh.
But there are several forms of exertional rhabdomyolysis that seem to be particularly prevalent within certain breeds. And we now know that there are at least two genetic forms of exertional rhabdomyolysis that affect horses.
So does that imply then that there could be ongoing sort of chronic problems then in racehorses, for example?
I think for sure, certainly in some racehorses, there may be an underlying chronic problem, and these are the racehorses that may indeed have a genetic problem. In other racehorses, it may be more of a sporadic type of problem.
So is the exertional rhabdomyolysis syndrome very easy to diagnose with pathognomonic symptoms, or is there a specific means that one requires to diagnose it?
So in the cases where it's not immediately obvious, and for sure there are some horses where they perhaps just become a little stiff after exercise and it's not immediately clear, really the best way to confirm the diagnosis that the horse has got a significant muscle problem is to take a blood sample. And we can measure specific enzymes that are normally present in muscle cells but which leak into the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And generally in horses that have had an episode or are having an episode of exertional rhabdomyolysis, those muscle enzymes are very high. The muscle enzymes we measure are known as creatine kinase and aspartate aminotransferase. And that's really the most specific way to identify that the animal has a muscle problem.
Okay. Is there a specific and effective treatment that one can use for this at the moment?
I think one of the problems that vets have faced in the past is that we've not been very good at recognising that there are, in fact, multiple different causes for this syndrome. And as a result, people have tried different forms of treatment, perhaps for different causes of the syndrome, not knowing exactly which type of the syndrome or which type of disease they're treating. And as a result, there are lots of different treatments that are suggested and that are out there in veterinary textbooks and in lay journals, many of which have questionable efficacy, and some of which may have some success, but quite a number of them haven't been tested appropriately. So I think it's perhaps better to discuss that, you know, some of the specific entities within this syndrome, and there are for sure some treatments that seem to be useful for some of those causes.
Okay, so it's very much if you like horses for courses, then, to use the appropriate pun.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's very often the case in veterinary medicine that when you have lots and lots of different potential treatments for a disease or a syndrome, it's true to say that when you get that, very often the reason we have lots of different treatments is because none of them works particularly well.
Right, okay. Well, perhaps we can come back to some specifics when we move on to the some of the genetic disorders. But I'm just wondering what the biochemical basis is of the muscle damage that's occurring in these disease syndromes.
So given that there are lots of different potential precipitating causes for the syndrome, it may be that the primary abnormality, or indeed it certainly is the case that the primary abnormality is different. But we often feel that what ends up happening is that for some reason there's perhaps an inability to maintain the energy processing within the cell, and as a result, electrolyte concentrations, in particular perhaps calcium, may rise inside the muscle cell, mm-hmm. and that activates a number of enzymes which may then lead to the clinical signs and effectively the disruption of the muscle cell and its leakiness.
Okay, so I mean really it's sort of activating enzymes that are effectively destroying the muscle itself.
That's yeah. Right. And in severe cases, the extent of muscle damage can be very severe, involving muscles all over the body, not just necessarily muscles associated with locomotion for the horse, but other muscles associated with posture, etc.
Right, okay, so and it's not necessarily therefore strictly associated with a particular type of activity, for example?
Not necessarily. In fact, perhaps strangely, it seems that certain forms of rhabdomyolysis seem to be brought on more frequently by relatively light exercise, and certainly that's my experience talking to horse owners. When they have a horse that seems to have this as an underlying problem, they say sometimes it's really a very minimal amount of exercise that seems to bring the problem on.
Okay, so what would you sort of characterise then as the main sort of potential underlying causes of rhabdomyolysis then?
Well, if we talk about perhaps what have been regarded as the acquired or the sporadic causes first of all, mm-hmm. there are perhaps three or four different possibilities that have certainly been suggested, and the evidence for some of these is rather weak, but there's perhaps some evidence for others. The first thing would be a horse that has been inadequately trained, not particularly fit, that is suddenly asked to do an excessive amount of exercise. And we know from work in horses, but also work in other animals, for instance, sled dogs, that if they're expected to do more exercise than they're trained for, they can develop this as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like the photographs or the TV that we all see every year with people trying to finish the London Marathon, that kind of thing.
Yes, okay. So, I mean, you referred earlier to particular genetic problems which will predispose to the condition or particular manifestations of it. I understand one of those that you're particularly interested in is polysaccharide storage myopathy. So what can you tell us about the sort of basis of that type of disease?
Okay. So within the syndrome, there are important inherited causes of exertional rhabdomyolysis. And one of these is indeed a disease known as polysaccharide storage myopathy. This was a disease that was first recognized by a group from Minnesota in the United States in quarter horses. Now, in the UK, we have relatively few quarter horses, but just a year ago or so, the Minnesota group identified the causative mutation for polysaccharide storage myopathy, and it turns out that it's a mutation which increases the activity of a key enzyme involved with storing glycogen, which is the energy storage molecule in muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And these horses increase the amount of glycogen storage in their muscle, and they start to form what's known as abnormal polysaccharide, a form of polysaccharide or carbohydrate that is unlikely to be able to be utilized by the cell, and that seems to increase as the horse gets older. These horses, they have a variety of different defects, but exertional rhabdomyolysis is certainly a common problem in them. Some other horses of other breeds with this same mutation can sometimes present with other signs such as weakness or gait abnormalities. Now, we've been very interested to try to find out if horses in the United Kingdom with exertional rhabdomyolysis that are not quarter horses also have this same mutation. And we've recently identified that, in fact, a significant proportion of horses that tie up with exertional rhabdomyolysis in the UK do have this mutation, in fact.
Okay, so is this what particular genetic defect that is very widely apparent then and as the cause of this problem, or is this just quite specific to the sort of quarter horse disease?
So I think up until fairly recently, this was regarded to be a quarter horse specific disease. But we've now demonstrated that this is a problem and a mutation that's also found in a number of breeds that are seen in the UK. We found it in warm blood horses, we found it in certain draft horses, in ponies, in polo ponies. We've also found it in horses that are crossbred. So we've seen it in a thoroughbred cross and in an Arabian cross horse. Because this is a disease that only requires one affected parent to be inherited, it's possible, therefore, to actually see it in a variety of different breeds.
So how does the abnormal amount of stored polysaccharide then have a negative effect on the muscle?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's a question that many people, including myself, are trying to answer at the moment. We're not quite sure whether the accumulation of this abnormal polysaccharide in itself is responsible for the syndrome of exertional rhabdomyolysis, or whether it's an innocent bystander, if you like, and in fact there are other functional or rather dysfunctional problems in the muscle cell. The abnormal polysaccharide itself forms, as I said earlier, as horses get older when they have this mutation. And it seems that perhaps when the horse is younger, their mutation causes them to store excessive amounts of normal glycogen. And then that in itself, over time, starts to result in the formation of this abnormal polysaccharide. Glycogen in muscle is effectively formed from the joining together of successive glucose molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the glycogen molecule is generated is through chains, and every so often there's a branch in that chain, and the elongation of the chain is brought about by the action of glycogen synthase, which is actually the protein that's mutated in these horses. And the branches that form in the glycogen molecule are formed by the action of branching enzyme.
Mm.
It seems that in these quarter horses and other horses that have polysaccharide storage myopathy, the ratio of the activity of glycogen synthase and branching enzyme, so there is too much glycogen synthase activity for a given amount of branching enzyme activity. And as a result, we get long, elongated chains of this filamentous polysaccharide. And that is, until recently, what was the pathognomonic change that was observed in muscle biopsies from these horses. When we looked at the muscle under the microscope, you could see evidence of this abnormal polysaccharide inside a number of their muscle fibers.
Okay, so that's the story end with the polysaccharide storage myopathy, but you mentioned there are a number of different genetic abnormalities. So, for example, is there one that you're particularly concerned with in thoroughbreds, for example?
Yes, that is true. Although I think it's quite likely that there are a number of genetic causes. In fact, at the moment, we really only recognise two, one of them being polysaccharide storage myopathy. But thoroughbreds appear to have a specific and different problem, although the clinical signs can be remarkably similar.
Right.
And these thoroughbreds have what appears to be an abnormality in the way that they handle cellular calcium levels.
Mm.
Now, calcium in muscle has a variety of different functions, the main one being to activate the contraction mechanism that actually allows the muscles to contract. And it seems that thoroughbreds that have this disorder have an inability to regulate the way calcium is controlled within their muscle cells. And as a result, we feel that that may then precipitate the syndrome of exertional rhabdomyolysis in them.
So if an owner's had a horse with repeated occurrences of exertional rhabdomyolysis, how would you go about dealing with that?
Okay, so that would be partly dependent on the breed of the horse. Certainly, a thorough clinical examination and history are always appropriate in these cases. But assuming that that's already been done and has not shed further light on the problem, then there are really two things that I would recommend. The first is a muscle biopsy. This is a procedure that can be done with the horse standing under sedation and can be done really very quickly. My laboratory processes muscle biopsies on a regular basis. We get quite a few each week from horses all over Europe. And it can be very helpful seeing the extent of the pathology that there is within the muscle, but also in specific cases identifying the cause of the underlying problem. In certain breeds, and in particular quarter horses, it may be more appropriate to actually send off DNA from the horse. That could be either a hair root pluck sample or a blood sample, and DNA from those tissues can be tested for the specific mutation that causes polysaccharide storage myopathy. And then in those cases, if that mutation is positive, the horse can be treated appropriately. If the genetic testing comes back negative, then in those cases it would then be appropriate to go on to do a muscle biopsy.
Okay, and that's something that you handle through your lab at the RBC's Hawkshead campus?
That's correct. Yeah. So the muscle biopsies are done and handled at the lab at the RBC Hawkshead campus. The DNA testing, actually, we send out to the group in Minnesota.
So in these particular syndromes that you described, what then are you now recommending as best treatment modalities?
So certainly in some horses where it just seems to be a sporadic problem, the likelihood is that adequate training and not taking the horse out and doing an excessive amount of work may be entirely appropriate for these animals. But if owners have horses that seem to have a repeating problem of tying up, sometimes without any obvious precipitating cause, in these animals, I think it's well worth starting to consider that there may be an underlying genetic problem. Now, getting to the bottom of that genetic problem is probably the first thing to do, there are now genetic tests available for polysaccharide storage myopathy, and muscle biopsy would be appropriate in many cases. As it turns out, the treatment for polysaccharide storage myopathy has been worked up extensively, and we now know that adjusting the horse's diet, in particular increasing the amount of calories derived from fat rather than from carbohydrate, can be very helpful in these animals.
Okay.
But perhaps just as important, if not more important, it turns out that these horses respond very well to regular and consistent exercise, which means exercise 7 days a week. And we know that if animals have to have some time off, perhaps they've become lame or they've got sick from some respiratory virus or something like that, they're at increased risk of having an episode of tying up when they go back into work. So I can't emphasize enough how important it is that these animals have consistent exercise, and preferably that they're turned out rather than kept in a stable.
Right, okay, so as you say, 7 days a week then.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's quite a commitment.
Yes.
Yeah.
The thoroughbreds, on the other hand, also seem to respond to the same kind of diet adjustment. And although the mechanism of disease in the thoroughbreds and the horses with polysaccharide storage myopathy appears to be different, thoroughbreds with what's now known as recurrent exertional rhabdomyolysis also seem to respond to a higher fat and low carbohydrate diet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that in itself can be a problem for some racehorse trainers, just trying to get the horses to eat the diets, but that certainly seems to be successful. But there are some specific prophylactic treatments that are used in thoroughbreds, in particular a drug called dantrolene, which helps limit the release of calcium inside the muscle cell, and that can be given orally.
Are there concerns with performance when one alters the diet in that way? Or
from the perspective of the use of a drug like dantrolene, certainly at higher doses we know that dantrolene will cause weakness in horses, but with the exception of a couple of cases that I'm aware of, generally performance effects are not found in the animals in training. Of course, in a racehorse actually racing, they're not allowed to race while being administered dantrolene.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, it seems that once you've got the animal fit enough to race, the exertional rhabdomyolysis underlying problem doesn't seem to rear its ugly head.
Right.
With respect to whether the diet itself can influence performance, that in itself is a huge area of exercise physiology. It's not really my area, but a number of people have looked at the effects of higher fat and low carbohydrate diets on different types of exercise. It's not perceived to be a problem, at least in the horse owners where I recommend those diets. More of a problem actually is trying to get the animal to eat that amount of fat. There are a variety of commercial supplements available that have higher fat levels and lower carbohydrate levels, certainly some people advocate feeding vegetable oil to horses. The trouble with the vegetable oil is that at a certain level, most horses just stop eating the food because it's sloppy and presumably tastes nasty. So a balance needs to be achieved.
Okay, but it sounds very much like it's possible now to identify some of these syndromes and manage them effectively with the right level of commitment anyway.
Very much so. I think the important sort of take-home message is that there are actually almost certainly multiple causes of exertional rhabdomyolysis syndrome, each of them having slightly different effects within the muscle cell, but the end effects are very similar, and that's why we see these horses all with rather similar clinical signs. Worked up appropriately, which means an excellent history and clinical examination, sometimes with a muscle biopsy, sometimes with genetic analysis, we can come very much closer and sometimes reach a final substantive diagnosis, and then it's possible to make appropriate recommendations for dietary management, sometimes prophylactic drug management, and exercise management for these animals.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Richard, for that excellent summary of exertional rhabdomyolysis.
Thanks very much, Mark. My pleasure.
And thank you very much for listening to this latest edition of the RBC podcast. As ever, if you have any comments regarding the podcast, please feel free to email us at podcasts@rbc.ac.uk, and I hope very much you'll be able to join us once again next time around. Goodbye.